No. Is there another package on this one? There's two packages on that might be the back. Hey, folks. If you're standing in line for the packets, just go back and sit down. If you're standing in line for the packets, go back and sit down. I'll pass it down so it'll get to you. Okay? Three packets. Yeah. That's it. Take this back to the back and just let it get past.
Yeah, why don't we sit?
Just take one and go sit down. The packets will get to you, don't worry. You guys go sit down. It's okay. Packets will get to you, don't worry. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Yeah. How are you? There are only three packets. There are three packets here. Okay. If you get. Go back and sit down. We'll find your way. Three. Get three all together. Okay. Room looks crowded, doesn't it? Don't hand anything to me. Just hold on to it. Okay. There are three handouts. There are three handouts being passed around. Don't freak out. Okay. There are three handouts being passed around. If you don't have all three, let it go. It'll get to you sooner or later. And if it doesn't, the PDF. This is 1981. If you don't get the packet, it's not like you can't find it. Just let it go. You don't need it. It's okay. Okay. Sure you're in the right class? Let's make sure all this stuff is nailed down first. This is valuation. Everybody is for this class, right? How many of you are in my corporate finance class? I see a lot of familiar faces. Oh, not that many, actually. Okay. So, what do you guys think this class is going to be about? Okay. Valuation. That's a good answer. Okay. So I'm going to start off with a story. That's how I fill in 28 sessions. I don't have enough stuff to actually teach this class. So I'm going to tell you stories every 20 minutes or so. It lets you fill in the time. I came to NYU in 1986. And when I came to NYU, they gave me a class to teach. It was a class called Security Analysis. For those of you who've never heard of this class, it has a very long and hoary tradition. It was actually taught in the 1950s by a guy called Ben Graham at Columbia. And he had some very famous students, one of whom you probably can name. Does anybody remember the guy called Warren Buffett? That was 1950s. 1986, I come to teach. They give me that class to teach. I take one look and say, I'm not teaching this class. It's the most boring class I've ever seen. Because here's what it was by 1986. It was 4 weeks on stocks, about 3 weeks on bonds, a week on option, a week on futures, and 5 weeks on institutional details. Like what? There was a whole class on listing requirements for the New York Stock Exchange. A whole class. Teaching was so easy in the days before Wikipedia. You could actually look up the 12 listing requirements, show up in class, spend all class talking about the 12 listing requirements, and people thought you were a genius. So I took one look at the class. I'm not teaching this class. Not a great attitude if you've just been hired as an assistant professor. So I went to the head of the department and I said, look, I don't want to teach this class. He was a good guy. He said, what would you like to teach instead? I said, I'd like to teach a valuation class. He said, don't do it. There isn't enough stuff in valuation to fill a class. And you know what? He was absolutely right. In 1986, there wasn't enough stuff in valuation to teach a class. There wasn't another school in the world that had a valuation class. But I really, really wanted to teach this class. I discovered very early in my academic life that if you want to get something done in academia, the best way to do it is to do it subversively. Because if you try to get official permission, here's what would happen. A committee would be formed. You know what happens when committees get formed? They take on a life of their own. 3 years later, that committee would report to another committee, which would report to a third committee. And by the time they got back to me and said, you can teach the class, I'd be ready to retire. So I said, you know what? Forget I asked you that question. I'll teach you security analysis class. And I walked in and taught a valuation class. They have no idea what I do in this room. We could spend the next 15 weeks talking about movies, and they'd have no idea. I know it's recorded, but they don't watch the webcast. You know how long it took them to catch on? In 2008, I get a call from the dean's office. So we hear you're teaching a valuation class. I said, yes, I've been doing it for 22 years. They said, we don't see it on the schedule. I said, that's simple. You've been giving me all these other classes to teach, and I've been hijacking them and teaching a valuation class instead. For 12 years, this class was called Equity Instruments and Markets. I am not in the least bit interested in markets. I don't even care about instruments, and I'm not even sure I want to talk about equities, which you take out the equity instruments and the markets out of that title. All you're left with is and. So I could fill in whatever I wanted, valuation and valuation. They said, that's not right. We should call it valuation. I said, I agree. So if you look at the NYU class schedules, you'll see valuation starting to show up in 2008. For some reason, in the undergraduate version, it's called equity evaluation. Now, I'm just going to teach evaluation classes. As I said, I hijack other classes, so I don't know what they normally teach in an equity evaluation class in an undergraduate program, but this is my evaluation class, the exact same class I would teach the MBAs. Now, don't give me that crap of we're undergraduates, we can't handle it. If MBAs can do evaluation, you can do valuation. They're actually more disconnected from numbers than many of you are. Some of them forgotten how to add, subtract, multiply, and divide because it's been so long since they've seen a number. So this is the same valuation class I've essentially taught for 31 years. Do I teach the class the same way? Not really. Why? Because I've learned, as I've taught this class, things I didn't know I should be learning before I taught the class. So feel sorry for the 1986 and 1987 and 88 classes because they were my lab experiments. So what I'm going to start off with today is kind of a philosophical basis for this class, what we're going to try to do in this class. Before I embark on that mission, let's get some logistical stuff out of the way. You know my name already, right? Should I say it because it gets mispronounced so often? They actually did one of those Stern Follies where they stopped people on Washington Square Park, showed them my name, and made them pronounce it. It's been pronounced so many different ways, I don't even remember how to pronounce it myself. It's got so many A's and O's in it that by the time you're done, you can mix up any number of A's and O's and end up with a different version of my name. I've actually always wanted a name like James Bond. So when I say my name is, I don't feel this incredible urge to complete it. My name is Bond, James Bond. It's not. My name is, I think, Damodaran. My first name is Aswath. So now that's been out of the way. You can misspell it as you go along. I won't even fix it. Frankly, I don't care how you spell my name because it comes to me anyway. My office is 969 KMAC. Okay? You can always see it because there's a little Apple sticker on the door, so it kind of gives me away. I'll talk about my homepage later. Your life is going to be get sucked up by that homepage somewhere along the way, so you're going to curse it by the time this class is done. But that's not my problem. There are my office hours. You can see that they're not that many office hours because starting next Monday, my corporate finance MBA class kicks in. It's in the same room. For some reason, I end up in this room every single semester. It's kind of funny. The first time, I have four kids, and they're all pretty much grown up, and they've all come to look at colleges, and they all lie to you when they do these college tours. What you kind of expect. So my son, my oldest son, when he's looking at colleges, looks at NYU. They do the tour and they bring you to that stone thing outside. And they say, the biggest classroom in NYU is right below, talking about this room. But don't worry, you will never have a class in that room because they don't actually have classes in that room. It's for lectures. And I feel like putting up my hands, that's a lie, that's a lie. I teach there every semester. So starting next week, I'll have two classes of 325. So if I get confused and send you an email you were not supposed to get, just let it go. Probably the class, you know, email meant for them. So my office hours have to be kind of, have to dance around the two classes. But here's a piece of advice that's going to sound really weird, but those of you in my corporate finance class probably remember it. The best time to actually catch me in my office is actually not during my office hours. Not because I'll be trying to hide during that time, but because that's when people will start to show up because that's what you're supposed to do. What I call the fair game principle. Corporate finance, if you're in my class, you remember what that principle is. What is that principle? No, that's not. You've restated my principle here. The fair game principle is? If you find me, I'm fair game. For the next 15 weeks, we're going to play a little game, or I'm going to try to make it as hot. No, actually not. You find me on the stairs, you can ask me a question. You find me in the elevator, you can ask me a question. You find me in the restroom, don't ask me a question. because partly it'll be sexist, right? The only half of this class, or so I can't do it. It wouldn't be fair. I'd probably be guilty of breaking some law somewhere along the way. I used to go to Kohl's before they knocked it down. I don't know what they're building, some monstrous device, you know, edifice there. And I remember there was one semester where I'd get on a treadmill, and almost like clockwork, this person in my class would show up on the next treadmill. And while I was running, he would pepper me with questions. So I'm going to introduce a rule. My pulse rate exceeds 100. I will not be responsible for any answers I give you. So if I'm running to the train and you're running next to me and ask me a question, I'll answer, but you'll have no idea what the answer is. Okay? So you can find me. I'm an easy person to find, whether it's in the semester or other. And the best way to actually find me is to send me an email. I'm usually pretty good about answering my emails. Don't send me text messages. Don't try to tweet me questions. Let's keep it old tech here, right? Email questions. There are three TAs for the class. Chanel is in the front row, so he's going to be one of the TAs. You can harass him. No, actually, don't. I'll list the office hours for them as we go along. And they will have a TA session once every week for those people who want to kind of get their hands dirty. So once a week for an hour, so you can ask them questions from past exam questions, etc. But don't exploit them. Don't be too aggressive with them. So you ready? Let's talk about this class. I'm going to start with a question that's going to lay the foundations for this class. Is valuation an art or a science? Let's start with the easier part of half the question. Is valuation a science? Is mathematics a science? In fact, it is the only pure scientist. Mathematicians are convinced that everybody else is just playing at science. What makes mathematics a science? In other words, 3 plus 2 is 5. No matter where in the world you stand or whatever principles you bring in, math, the inputs are right, the output is defined. Physics is mostly a science. We all could go up to the 11th floor, knock out one of the windows, and all jump out at the same time. And guess what? We don't fall in the order of IQ or how much we know about valuation. We all hit the ground at the same time because the laws of gravity are the laws of gravity. Math is a science. Physics is mostly a science. So now that I've framed what a science looks like, do you think valuation is a science? What's the question I'm asking you? If you get all the inputs right into a valuation, is your value going to be the right number? It's not even close. You can get every single input right and be horribly wrong. Start getting used to it. Especially those of you who want confirmation. I've done all the numbers. Did I get the answer right? Valuation is definitely not a science. Is it an art? Is painting an art? Let me ask you a question. What makes this Picasso guy so special? I've never understood it. In fact, I remember taking my oldest son when he was 8. They had a Picasso exhibit at the Met. He wasn't impressed. He said, this guy can't get the nose in the right place. Have you noticed this? Nose comes out of the side of the head, the top of the head. He was a little confused or drugged or drunk or whatever he was. But for whatever reason, we've all gathered together. Picasso, great artist. His painting is worth $80 million. You could start painting and putting noses in the wrong place. You're not going to get $80 million for your paintings. You know what makes an art? Is you really cannot teach it. You either are a great artist or you're not. You can learn the little pieces of paint, but you're not going to become a Picasso. Thank God valuation is not an art, because if it is, I wasted 31 years of my life trying to teach something that cannot be taught. So valuation is not a science. It's not an art. So what the heck is it? You know what I'd like to use to describe valuation? It's a craft. I'll give you the discipline that I think is closest to valuation, cooking. How do you master cooking? Is it by watching the Food Network and watching all those cooking shows? My daughter watches the Food Network all day long. She can't cook a lick, but she watches every show. Yeah. Cutthroat Kitchen all day long. chopped, one show after the other. The reality is, don't learn cooking by watching TV shows. You don't learn cooking by reading cookbooks. You learn cooking by doing what? By going into that room in your apartment or house called the kitchen. Remember that? You've been avoiding it like the plague because you've been taking takeout for the last 4 years. You learn cooking by going to the kitchen and starting to cook. And the first time you cook, guess what happens? Disaster. I remember the first time I scrambled eggs. Nobody told me you're supposed to spray the damn pan. I scrambled the egg. It looks pretty good, but I can't get the egg off the pan. I had to throw both the pan and the egg into the trash can. But I learned, if you don't spray the pan, bad things happen to you. They never showed that on Chopped. It happens magically. You learn cooking by doing. And each time you cook, you learn something you didn't know until you tried that out, right? You learn valuation by doing. So you know what you're going to be doing in this class? You're going to learn valuation by doing. In fact, every week for the next 15 weeks, I'm going to put up a valuation of the week up on the website for the class, the webpage for the class. And I'll direct your attention. Don't worry, I'll constantly remind you that the class is going on, even if you want to check out. So I'm going to put up my valuation. I'll put up an Excel spreadsheet containing my valuation. And I'm going to put up a Google shared spreadsheet where I'll say, hey, why don't you try valuing whatever I value? What am I going to value? Whatever strikes my fancy. It's all about me anyway. So you know what I'm going to value tomorrow and put up on my website? I'm going to value the Star Wars franchise. Why start with some boring thing like valuing Amgen? Let's value the franchise. I'm going to put up a valuation I first did after I watched, when Force One came out about a year ago, December. I went to the movies, I went and watched the movie with my kids and came back home and I said, I've got something to do, and I disappeared for about 45 minutes. I put up a valuation of Star Wars right after. You're going to see that valuation and I'm going to ask you to try. And you know what your reaction is going to be, right? It's just the first week. I don't know anything about valuation. So go ahead, give it your best shot. And in the first week, here's what I expect many of you to do, at least the people who try. You'll take my valuation and you'll change the third decimal point on my risk-free rate. And you let it go. And you say, oh, you know what? Magically, my value came in very close to yours. And each week, I'm going to keep track of your valuations relative. And the first week, everybody's valuation is kind of centered around mine. And you know when I know the class is working? Is by week 5, you're willing to disagree with me. In week 8, one of you is going to get in my face and say, you were completely wrong in that valuation. Every single one of the assumptions was crappy. I'd say, class is working. You learn valuation by doing, which means there's some good news and bad news. We're going to do a lot of valuations over the next 15 weeks, and you're going to learn with each valuation that you do. The bad news is, if at the end of 15 weeks you think this, you have this thing nailed down, you're wrong. This is a process you've got to keep working on. I don't know how many companies I've valued over my life, 31 years times 52 weeks, and you can keep going. I still learn something new every time I value a company. This is a process. It's not going to end, but it's a process you got to go into and start trying your hand at valuation for you to be able to do it. So valuation is a craft, and what we're going to be spending the next 15 weeks on is that craft. Much of what I'm going to talk about over the next 15 weeks, I've learned in the course of teaching this class. Notice how I phrase that. I've learned in the course of teaching this class. And I'm going to let you see me struggle. So sometimes I'm going to start valuing a company, saying, you know what, guys, I'm stuck here. And I'm going to let you see how I try to get over that struggle, because the nature of valuation is you will get stuck. And whether you're good at valuation depends on how you get yourself unstuck. So valuation is a craft. Here's the second one. I've already given a little bit of the second theme away. I said I'm going to value the Star Wars franchise as my first valuation. most people, when they think about valuation, that's why I don't like this notion of equity in front. Because already saying we're going to value big publicly traded companies. We will value big publicly traded companies. But we'll also value small publicly traded companies. We'll value developed market companies and emerging market companies. We'll value companies across the life cycle, from startups all the way to companies in their death throes. And guess what? It's much more fun valuing a startup than a company that's one of the walking dead. We're going to value both small and large businesses, private and public businesses. We're going to value individual assets, like the Star Wars franchise. If I get a chance, I'm going to put up a valuation I did of Arian Foster. If you're an NFL fan, Arian Foster was a running back for Houston. And actually, this company took his earnings. They created a security where you could buy 20% of Arian Foster's earnings over his lifetime. It's actually Arian Foster sold 20% of its earnings. So you could buy a share of Arian Foster. You wish you'd bought a share of Matt Ryan today, right? Can you imagine if you'd bought Matt Ryan shares a year ago, how much they'd be worth today? You have no idea who I'm talking about. Just let it go again. Right? So maybe one of the valuations we'll do is, how do you value a portion? It sounds almost inhumane to be taking a human being's earnings power, but there's actually one of the proposals that's been offered for the high cost of tuition. You might have heard about this. Is there are people thinking about offering students free tuition in return for 20% of your earnings once you graduate. Hey, doesn't sound that bad today if you think about your student loans accumulating. So we're going to value just about any kind of asset, small or large, public or private, business or single asset. So this is a class about valuation of almost any kind of asset. Here's the third theme I want to emphasize, and this is something that's going to sound strange to some of you who've been through a lot of finance classes. In finance classes, we've developed this bad habit of using value and price as if they're interchangeable words. I'm going to argue in this class that if you want me to value something, you better tell me that you want it valued. If you want me to price something, then you have to tell me it has to be priced. You think, what's the difference? The value of an asset is based on its cash flows, growth, and risk. And we'll talk about the tools that we use to bring them all together. A discounted cash flow valuation is the value of an asset. You know what the price of an asset is based on? It's what other people are willing to pay for something very similar to your asset. If you want to see pricing in play, think about real estate. Think about trying to buy a house or an apartment. A realtor shows you the house or the apartment and names a number, right? This apartment is worth $400,000. Let me ask you a question. How did the realtor come up with that number? Did they do a discounted cash flow valuation of the apartment? I don't think so. They looked at other apartments in the neighborhood, other houses that looked like yours, and they extrapolated. That's pricing. I'm going to argue that many of the misconceptions in value come from the fact that we often use the word value when we mean price, and the word price when we mean value. So I'm going to draw a distinction. I'm going to talk about the tools that you would use when you're asked to value something, and then I'm going to talk about the tools that you would use when you price something. And I'm also going to talk about why in finance we've been so cavalier about mixing the two. And it's because of this notion, at least in finance, going back 50 years, of efficient markets. In an efficient market, what will happen? The value and the price will converge. But if you think about investing at its core, in investing, you are assuming that value and price can yield different numbers for the same company, the same business, and the same asset. And as an investor, you're trying to exploit the gap. So almost everything in investing boils down to, are you trying to value something or price something? If they're different, what do you plan to do about it? So that's the third theme you're going to see run through this class. And now comes a part that I kind of introduced at the start of my corporate finance class. But I'm going to ask a question, and I want this to be a question about you. So there's no right answer. Don't look at your neighbors. Don't look at me. So here's my question. If I asked you to classify yourself today, would you classify yourself more as a storyteller or more as a number cruncher? Think about it for a while, because each of you has already in your mind decided what you are. Are you more naturally a storyteller? are you more naturally a number cruncher? You're saying, how would I know? You know, and you've known for a long time. You probably knew when you were about 12 or 13. I'll tell you when I knew. I knew right after my first English literature class. I was 12 or 13. And I was asked to read Moby Dick. And I did. I was a good kid. I did. I showed up ready for the discussion. And I did all my research on whales and all my research on captains. Hey, Moby Dick, it's all about whales and captains. I show up, and they don't even mention whales. In fact, I remember the teacher saying, there is no whale. So what? There's this big black fish I read about all through the book. There is no captain. What? What's this Captain Ahab guy doing all over the book? He says, they're metaphors. He said, they really mean something else. And they started saying, talking about these hidden meanings. And I was sitting there saying, really? Really? That's what Herman Melville was thinking when he wrote that? And I remember walking out of that class saying, never again am I going to subject myself to this kind of bullshit. And my life was laid out for me. I avoided the literature classes like the plague. It was Algebra 1, Algebra 2, Algebra 3 out of high school. And these were the good old days when you could go to college and you didn't have this core curriculum crap that you guys have to deal with now, where they make you spend 2 years taking history classes. And you know why you need that, right? Without them, history departments would shrink and die. So basically, you're required to take history. Even I don't care about history. It doesn't matter. You need to take history, advanced history, super advanced history. I don't want to. No, no choice. Those days, you could just go number crunching, number crunching, number crunching, out of college, and you get a number crunching job. And you discover about 4 or 5 years into your number crunching job, that's incredibly boring. Sitting there entering numbers into a spreadsheet. So what do? You quit and you come back to business school. They're going to be in my MBA evaluation class. So when I asked this question last semester, out of the 300 people in my MBA evaluation class, 180 said, hey, we're number crunchers. We're engineers, recovering mathematicians, recovering scientists. But remember that class on Moby Dick, the class I walked out of in complete disgust? There were people who thought it was great seeing hidden meanings. They're the people who write poetry. My son writes poetry. He showed me his first poem. And I said, Kiran, I think there's a problem. I think the words are supposed to rhyme. That's the way I would start poetry. Last words. He said, Dad, that's because you're not a poet. I said, you're right. So these are the people who love writing and hidden meanings. They take literature 1, literature 2, literature 3. They become history majors at Yale. These are the people who actually take history classes, not because they're required to, but because they want to. I've never quite understood those people. Then they come out with a history major from Yale and they get a job. They discover that even Yale history majors don't get paid very much. So after about 3 or 4 years in that job, they decide they've had enough of being underpaid and living like a student for the rest of their lives. And they come back to school in my MBA class, the other. So in my 300-person class, 180 are number crunchers and 120 are storytellers. And you can already see the number crunchers. So let me ask that question here. How many people in this class are more naturally number crunchers? Come on, there have to be more. There's a selection bias here. You're in business school to begin with. But maybe that's... Yeah? So that's enough. How many of you are naturally storytellers? The number crunchers think they have the advantage right now, right? They say, what are you doing in this class? It's an evaluation class, not a strategy class, where you can tell story after story after story. Nobody's checking up on you. Let's face it, each group has its own delusions. Let's start with the number crunching group. Okay? Number crunchers, again, put up your hands. I'm one of you. So here are our shared delusions. You tell me whether you have these. The first is the delusion of precision. We think we're being precise because we use numbers. You know what the reaction of a number cruncher to being uncertain is? Add decimals. Okay? I'm feeling very uncomfortable. Let me add a few more decimals. 0.356. Because you think adding decimals make things look... It makes them look more precise. It's a delusion of precision. The second is the delusion of being objective. I'm using numbers. There's no bias here. The storyteller is so biased. You're going to discover how easy it is to bias evaluation using numbers. The third is the delusion of being in control. Notice this. If you think you have a number for something, you think you're in control of it. It's, of course, the story of healthcare, right? You go into a doctor. Now the doctor doesn't even talk to you. Runs 100 tests on you. Oh, the numbers all look good. Go home. I feel like I'm dying. Doesn't matter. The numbers all look good. You will die at least with good numbers. Okay? We think if we attach a number to something, we've got it nailed. Those are the delusions of the number crunchers. I'm not a storyteller, but I've learned their delusions as well. The first is a storyteller thinks that if they're creative, the more creative they are, the bigger the reward should be. I told you a really good story about in business. I should be worth at least $2 billion, right? I'll make it even more creative. Let's make it $5 billion. We think if you're creative, you should be rewarded. In fact, you think number crunchers dream in black and white. They're incapable of colorful dreams. You control that. And you love talking about experience. Anecdotal evidence is the way you justify things. You're like my mother-in-law. She is convinced, and she will tell you, that the best car to drive in a snowstorm is an old Volkswagen Bug. I remember the first time she said that. I said, that makes no sense. And I made the mistake I've made repeatedly since of asking her why. Because she tells me every single time. She said, 25 years ago, she was in Lake Tahoe. There was a snowstorm, and she was driving a Volkswagen Bug. You can see how the story is going to unfold. So in the snowstorm, 2 miles, she makes it back home safely. And on her way home, she saw at least 3 cars that were not Volkswagen Bugs that had gone off the road. You wait for it. So she says, don't you get it? That's why a Volkswagen Bug is the best car to have in a snowstorm. Sample size of one. Amazing how you can generalize from it, right? But storytellers love giving you anecdotal evidence. So each side has its own delusions, and left to their own devices, each side is going to have trouble doing valuation. To me, the definition of a good valuation is it's a bridge between stories and numbers. Sounds fancy, but in a good valuation, every story should have a number attached to it, and every number should have a story attached to it. So if you show me an Excel spreadsheet with a company valuation, I point to revenues in year 10 and say, why are your revenues $35 billion for your company? I don't want an answer like, I use 12% growth for the first 5 years, 7% after that. That's not an answer. I want you to tell me what your story is about this company and the product it produces and the market it serves that gives you $35 billion in revenues. And if you tell me a story, a really good story about this company having a great brand name or legal protection from competition, I'm going to say, where in your valuation are you going to show it? And if you can, that story has become numbers. So for me, this class is about connecting stories to numbers. So I'll give away the end game for what I hope you will get out of the class. If you're a number cruncher like me, I hope by the end of this class, you develop an imagination. Remember that thing you used to have when you were 7 years old that you bludgeoned into the ground starting at the age of 12? Let it out. I want you to become an imaginative number cruncher. And if you're a storyteller, I hope you get enough number crunching out of this class that you develop some discipline. You know what I mean by discipline? Storytellers love telling stories, and they often cross the line between reality and fantasy and tell me great fairy tales. Wonderful if you're a novelist, but not great in business. So to me, the essence of somebody who's good at valuation, you're either a disciplined storyteller or an imaginative number cruncher. I told you I've been teaching this class for 31 years, right? And every semester I struggle with getting this accomplished. Guess who I have more trouble with every single semester? Getting storytellers to develop discipline or number crunchers to develop an imagination. It's not even close. Which group do you think I have more trouble with? The number crunchers. You give me 100 history majors 24 hours from now, I can teach you enough valuation that you're on your way. You give me 100 number crunchers, I am screwed. This is it. Because getting you to let go of your safe zones. You know, you feel safe with numbers. And I want you to leave that safe spot and come over to places where you haven't been since you were 12 years old, before that first literature class. I say, it's okay. It's like coaxing you off land into the... Say, I can't swim. Yes, you can. So by the end of this class, in fact, the very last class, I'm going to come back with that question of, hey, if you're a number cruncher, do you feel more comfortable telling stories? And you're a storyteller, now do you feel more comfortable with numbers? So think of this class as a bridge between storytelling and number crunching. And there's a fifth and final theme for this class. And I'm going to use a word that you normally do not hear in a finance class. It's the word faith. What's the essence of faith? Whether it's religious faith or whatever faith, what's the essence of faith? Is you're willing to believe without proof, right? So if you're religious, you're willing to believe there's a God, even though you might not have scientific proof that God exists. When you do valuation, you don't do it because you're... Maybe you do, I don't. Because you're intellectually curious. I don't lie awake and say, I wonder what Tesla is worth right now. Are you crazy? I have better things to dream about. I do valuation for one reason and one reason alone. Which is, I'm greedy. I'd like to make money. In other words, there's no point to doing valuation if you're not willing to act on those valuations. And it's a lot more difficult than it sounds. Because let's say you pick a company to value and you value it, right? You come up with a value, it's much higher than the market price. Intellectually, you know what you should be doing, right? Which is buying the company and waiting. Now do you see where faith comes in? To act, you have to have faith in your own valuation. And you're going to discover that when you first value a company, you look at the numbers and say, oh my God, I made so many assumptions. I could be so wrong. You have to have faith in your own valuations, and you also have to have faith in... What else has to happen for you to make money, even if your valuation is right? The price has to move to your valuation. You have to have faith in your own valuation and faith that markets will correct their mistakes. And some of you are going to come in and ask me that question. Is there any proof that any of this works? Is there proof that I'm going to make money? And you know what I'm going to tell you? I'm going to remind you of the definition of faith. Is I have no proof that it's going to work, but you have to develop enough faith in your valuations and faith that markets correct their mistakes that you're willing to act. Will all of you develop that faith? No. In fact, at the end of this class, you might say, this is pointless. I can do valuation, but it's okay. There are so many other things you can do in life that don't involve valuation. Some of you will start a journey, and it is a journey, where you will develop faith as you go along. And that's the other thing I'm going to let you see. I'm going to value real companies, and I'm going to take real actions. So last semester when I taught this class, I valued Deutsche Bank in October. Those of you who have been reading the news, Deutsche has had a fair amount of trouble, and that's putting it mildly. I valued it at $20, the stock was at $13. So I put it up on my blog, and that's the other thing I'm going to draw your attention to. And I talked about it in class, and I said, I'm buying the stock. The problem with using real companies is when you make mistakes, everybody gets to see them in Technicolor. This was actually one of my good stories. It turned out I bought at 13 and the stock went to 19.75. I think this is why you do valuation. But I also valued Valiant at 27 and I said I have faith. And I bought the stock at 27. And every day the market docks on me, I said, do you still have faith? How about right now? And that's the nature of faith, is your faith will be tested, and you have to decide whether, in fact, you have enough faith. I still have enough faith, but every day that faith is tested. And that's something you're going to see in this class is, I'm going to value real companies, and you're going to see the price go in the other direction. And some of you say, how do you explain that? I said, it is what it is. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. Nobody's died. I just lost a little money. Let's move on. So, but that's part of what I want you to think about is don't expect at the end of 15 weeks to feel comfortable enough to act on your valuations. Because you will not have faith suddenly develop over 15 weeks. Think of this as a process that if you keep coming back to, you might develop enough faith to be able to act on your valuations. So let's lay out what this class is going to deliver. So for the next two sessions, you're going to see a lot of what you've seen already, the big picture of valuation, the themes that drive valuation. No? I'm going to lay out the different ways you can approach valuation. Then for about 10 sessions, we're going to talk about mechanics. And these 10 sessions will be partly review, if you remember, of your corporate finance class, but I tend to be a realist about these things. I assume that everybody forgets. It's like, you know, when you store things in your computer, you can store them either on the hard drive or on the memory that gets turned off the minute the computer gets turned off. I assume that almost everything you learn in a class goes into that instantaneous memory. So when you go off at the end of the class, you turn that switch off, everything gets wiped out. I might be cynical, so I will assume nothing. But we will revisit some of the things we did in corporate finance and build on. Things like, what's a risk-free rate? How do we measure risk? What's a risk premium? How do we get cash flows? So that's about 10 sessions of nitty-gritty detail that you have to pay attention to when you value companies. And I'll tell you up front, you're not going to see a single company valued all the way through in those 10 sessions. You're going to say, when are we going to actually value companies? When are we going to do full valuations? I just wait. Then I'm going to hit you with about 35 valuations in three sessions where all we do is value companies. Because once you've got the mechanics nailed down, I can jump around. I can value an Indian company, a Brazilian company, a U.S. company, a startup, and you're going to see valuation play out in all these actual valuations. So for the first 16 sessions in this class, we're going to talk about value and discounted cash flow valuation and intrinsic valuation. So by the end of the 16th session, if I came to you with a business or an asset and asked you to put a value on it, you should be able to do it. Then we're going to spend about 5 or 6 sessions talking about pricing. Anytime you use a multiple, price-earnings ratios, EV to EBITDA, price to book, which is what a lot of analysts use, you are pricing something, we're going to talk about how to do it right. I have no problem with pricing assets if you do it right, so we're going to talk about the process of pricing. Once we've got value and pricing, then we can have some fun. We can talk about what's different if you have to value individual assets in a business. A liquidation valuation, a sum of the parts valuation, and God forbid, an accounting valuation. What's different about that? Then we're going to get high tech. We're going to take the one aspect of valuation that's new and different. We apply option pricing in the context of valuing certain kinds of companies. These are called real options. Young startups, natural resource companies. So we're going to talk about valuing. Intermingled in there, I'm going to talk about what's different about valuing a private business as opposed to a public company. Let's say your father owns a business. How would you value that business? And we'll close off with a couple of loose ends. Valuing acquisitions, what's different about valuing an acquisition? What has to be brought in, which you wouldn't do in a regular valuation? And what if your job is not to value the company from the outside, but actually run the company from the inside and change the value of the company? After all, that's why you're hired as a management. And think of this as the session where corporate finance fully meets valuation, because corporate finance is about all those levers you have as a manager to change the value of a company. How do you pick investments? How much do you borrow? How much do you pay in dividends? We'll bring it all together. And in the last session, I call the grand finale. We'll talk about that later. Because by the time you get to the grand finale, you'll be ready to leave. So that's good. That's a nice partition between the class and everything else. Now, it's too late to do pre-season prep, but I did send you the... You guys have been getting my emails, right? I know that you have this thing of, I don't get any of your emails. Now, how many of you have not been getting my emails? Okay. You have a problem, not me. The problem is probably that your email... What I do is I actually use the alias, the email alias created for the class. So if you're not getting the email, either your email address in that alias is not right, or you're out from outside Stern, in which case they don't know what to do with you. They've created a Stern email. They do this all the time. They create a Stern email for you and don't let you know. I don't know how they expect you to find out that you're... But the key is for you to find out what it is, because some of the things you will be doing in this class will require Stern email, like accessing Capital IQ, yeah, which is one of the databases you'll be accessing. So basically, in that email, I said there are three things I will ask that you bring into the class. One is basic accounting. It's not even basic accounting. Can you read a financial statement? Do you know the difference between operating income and net income? Can you explain to me why book value of equity can become negative? The answer to all three questions, I have no idea. Then I have a primer, which is about 10 pages long, that is all the accounting you need to know. That's the way I think about accounting. After about 10 pages, everything else you know is kind of, I don't care about. So this is the basic stuff. Can you read? Basic statistics. Statistics was designed for valuation. Because the essence of statistics is making sense of large and contradictory data, right? So when I said, do you understand basic statistics, I'm talking about, can you take large amounts of data and make them manageable by computing averages and standard deviations, looking at distributions? Again, not high-tech statistics, but basic statistics. And if your answer is no, I have about a 10-page primer on all the statistics you need to know. So click that primer and you should be able to read. And corporate finance is a prereq for this class, I think. But as I said, there's very little prereq, I will assume. But we will draw out some basic stuff, because I'm not going to derive the CAPM in this class. I have other things I need to do. So if you have no idea what the CAPM even is, so maybe you want to review the corporate finance, at least see the expansion of what CAPM is. Okay? So we will draw out some very basic present value. If you're still at war with your calculator, where you're not sure who's running who, win the war, right? If I give you 10 years of cash flows, I don't want to, and they're the same cash flows every year, I don't want you to stake your one cash, I don't want to see this, the equation of 10 numbers. I want you to trust the PV function in your calculator enough to use it. Is that asking too much? Because otherwise you're going to be wasting your time doing things that you can use on something much better. So very basic stuff. So if you get a chance, check out those primers because they give you everything you need to know, at least to get this class started. Now, for the next 15 weeks, I'm going to harass you. I'm going to be, you know, on your door every day. So I'm going to tell you how the weeks are going to unfold. Every Monday we have class, obviously. Right after the class, by the end of today, you get an email. About what? About the class. Saying, remember the class? I want you to forget by 7 o'clock we had a class and what we talked about. So I will remind you, I'll kind of pull together. So it's not a big deal, just kind of. And if I can find other things that might be interesting connected with what we did today, I'll send you links to those. So that'll be Monday. Tuesday, I'll put up my valuation of the week. As I said, tomorrow you're going to see the Star Wars valuation go up. I'll send an email that says, this is what I posted. This is my Excel spreadsheet. This is the Google shared spreadsheet. Go give it a shot. It will not be graded. So you're saying, why would I do it? It's up to you. Evaluation is a craft and you choose not to do it, it's fine. Your cooking is going to taste like crap in week 15. But that's a choice you have. And you're going to find this in this class. There are a lot of things I will put out there in this class that I don't require you to do. You can do it if you feel like doing it. So it's up to you to decide how much you want. I mean, some people have described this class as trying to drink out of a hose. And that's what it's going to feel like. Does this guy ever stop? No. So I'm going to hose you down every day. How about this? How about that? And you're saying, no, I just want a sprinkle. Sorry. Okay. Take the little sprinkle and leave the rest. Wednesday, we'll have class again. And I'll put up what I call a weekly challenge of the week. You're saying, what the hell is that? I'm going to take what we did this week and take a problem that's one level more difficult than what we did in class. What I'm trying to see is, can you take what you learned in class and extend it? Because I'm not just happy with you just apply things. This isn't just a plug and chug class where you can plug in the equation. I can do that. I wanted to take whatever you learned in this class and take it one extra step. And that's what the weekly challenge, again, not graded. I'll put it up on Wednesday. I'll let you know when it's up. And by Sunday, I will put up the solution, and you can check your solution. So you don't have to send your solution to me. I'm not going to check it. I'll put the solution up. You can check what you did against the solution. And it might seem like extra work you don't have to do, but you'll find that it actually makes whatever you learn in the class kind of stick. On Thursday, I'll send you an email about the project. You're saying, what project? You're going to find out soon enough. That's going to take over the other half of your life. You're saying, what am I going to do with all my other classes? I don't care. This is the only class that matters to me. I'm going to act like none of your other classes even count. Those instructors are going to be pissed off at me, but that's not my problem. On Friday, I'll do a topical webcast. What is that? Basically, this is something very base, you know, something that practical, like how do you read a 10K? So what I do every week is I've got this social media obsession. I'm like a Kim Kardashian on this one. I want to get a lot of people following. So I sit in front of my computer and I say, okay, you know what? I'm going to read a 10K and I'm going to do it publicly. So what I do is I take the 10K and I read it. So I go through and do a little YouTube video, 15-minute video. This is the 10K I read. So this sounds like definitely Miss TV, right? But this is basically on all the things you will have to do. So we'll talk about converting leases to debt. So I will take a company with leases and say, this is the process. So these are very practical webcasts on things you have to do, nuts and bolts stuff that I don't want to do in class. On Saturday, I'll send you a weekly newsletter saying, what news? One of the things you're going to discover is as you go through this class and you get to week 6 or 7, you're very quickly going to forget where you are in the class. So think of this newsletter like a GPS. So I'm saying, this is where we are. This is where we plan to be. So this isn't gripping news. It's really to kind of keep you connected to the class in those weeks where you get really busy and say, where are we in this class? Right? And Sunday, I'll send you the solution to the weekly challenge and set up the week to come. So there are about, I counted 123 days between now and May 8th. You're going to get 116 emails over the 123 days. So what, 7 days? What's it? Spring break, I'm going to let you kind of be free. Okay? So you're going to get pretty much one email a day from me. So if you want to block me, do it quickly. Okay? So I will create what I call an email chronicle, which means every email I'll create an HTML file, because here I do it in self-defense. Because I know there will be times when I say, remember that I told you there was a project due in an email, and you know what your response is? I didn't get that email. Right. Someone said, there's an email chronicle. You can go check every email in this class. So that chronicle, by the time we're done, is going to have all 1 to 23 emails on it. I have very few rules in this class. As you can see, I'm not the most intimidating person in the world. When I first started teaching, I tried to be like John Houseman in The Paper Chase. If you've never seen this movie, this is a very intimidating character. You can also point at people and people quake. It doesn't work for me. So I'm going to make my pleas up front. So please try to be in class and please try to be on time. But I'd rather you be here than not be at all. So even if you're 20 minutes late, just walk in. As you can see, the class is so big, I have no idea. You know, you can bring your mother, your grandmother, your brother, your sister, your dog. I don't care. Everybody can show up. You know, the more the merrier. Please try to be in class. Bring your lecture notes with you. I don't want this extra question I want to ask. How many of you have bought the lecture note? Is the lecture note packet available at the bookstore yet? No. Okay. That's typical bookstore. I gave them like 2 weeks. For whatever reason, copying is too involved a process. But you know what? Their loss is your gain. There's a PDF version of the same lecture notes for which you pay nothing. Download the PDF. Please, please don't use the printers in these two buildings. Because you know what's going to happen. 300 people try to print off. There are about 800 pages worth of lecture notes, slides for this page. 300 times 800, you can work out the math. That means every printer in these two buildings will be broken by the end of the semester, and I will hear about it. So if you have to print these notes off, do you have any of your part-time jobs? Just print it off at wherever you work. They have no idea. They have these huge printers, lots of pages coming through. Act like it was a mistake. I hit the page. I don't know what happened. But that's the one thing I want you to come to class with, because every slide you see on up there, you will have new lecture notes, which means I don't want you to be spending your entire 80 minutes or 75 minutes writing down everything I say. Nothing I say is that profound. But the slides will be there and you can make the notes on the side. So it's for your own protection, I think the lecture notes are good. I hope you don't have to miss classes, but I know you will. For whatever reason, you're sick, you act like you're sick, you think you want to be sick, whatever it is, you know. Or you have interviews and you've, you know. So whatever it is, I'm a realist on this. If you miss a class, it's okay. Don't email me apologizing for missing the class. I didn't even notice you were gone. I'm sorry. Okay? But you will be able to catch up on the class without having to show up in my office. So every class will be available as a stream. So basically, I'll put the stream up. For that, you need, you know, a broadband connection. It'll also be available as a YouTube video. As I said, the Kim Kardashian part of me is acting up. So every one of the 28 sessions will be available as a YouTube video. They'll be available as a downloadable video file. This is if you want to download it before you get on a long plane trip so you can watch lecture after lecture after lecture instead of watching all the stupid movies. Or as a downloadable audio file. This is if you want to get on a treadmill and listen to a lecture while you run. This might make you run faster. Okay? Saying, I want to run away from this lecture, maybe it'll make you fitter. No? In other words, there'll be multiple ways you can get the lectures. There should be no reason you fall behind on this class. So if you had to, I mean, there have been people who have actually had to go back to Asia for 4 weeks in the middle of the semester, have been able to take every class pretty much in real time. Okay? Now, there's no required book for this class. That said, if you want a book, I have lots of choices. I have 5 books on valuation. Pick any one. My suggestion is pick the cheapest one, unless you have lots of cash and you just want to throw it away. Okay? The book that probably best fits this class as a textbook is the Investment Valuation book. It's in its 3rd edition. It's a big, hefty, fat book. It's kind of intimidating to carry around. Carry it around to intimidate other people rather than yourself. Okay? Then the second book is very egotistically named, A Modern Valuation. It's actually my very first book. And I remember writing it in 91, and my publisher saying, why don't you call it De Modern Valuation? I said, well, nobody's heard of me. Well, can I say O.J. Simpson Valuation? Because O.J. Simpson was in the news, right? So that's actually a book that's actually not written as a textbook, but it's written more for practitioners. Then I have The Dark Side of Valuation, which is my dark side coming out. This is about difficult to value companies, which is actually my favorite kind of valuation. There's a little book of valuation, and it's really a little book. It's about 150 pages long. This is for people with really short attention spans who don't want to deal with equations, but it kind of has enough stuff. And my newest book just came out 2 weeks ago about storytelling and number crunching. Okay, so basically, it's about connecting stories to numbers. You can get any of those books and none of them. You can get all of them if you feel like throwing money away. I really don't require the books, but I'll let the choice be to you. So you might decide somewhere during the course of the semester that what you want to learn more about is narrative and numbers or the dark side of valuations. I'll let you pick. How many of you have Apple devices? Okay. If you have an Apple device, visit the iTunes store and type in the word UValue. You'll see an app pop up. Okay. Download the app. Trust me, there are no viruses lurking there. I'm not going to ask you for a credit card. It's actually a valuation app. This is for the geek in each and every one of you. What I want you to do, actually, is the next time your flight is delayed, open the app. You have 30 minutes to go value a company. It's not the kind of thing that normal people do while they're waiting for a delayed flight. But it's actually an app that on your iPhone you can enter the numbers. It's actually a pretty versatile app, and it'll value Apple or Twitter or Snap when it goes public. Yeah. And I have an iPad and iPhone version. You're saying, what about those of us who have Androids? It's your problem, not mine. So, as I said, I'm an Apple user. I don't even understand the notion of an Android. There's going to be no Android version of it. And if you have BlackBerry, that's dead technology walking. That's almost impossible to even visualize. Okay? Now, here's how you can stay connected to class. One is, of course, you can use the website, the web page for the class. That is actually the central location for everything for this class. The emails, the lectures, you can find them all. You can also, if you have, you're again an Apple device, but you can do this even with an Android device. You can download this app called iTunes U. If you haven't downloaded it, try it out. It's actually a neat app. And once you've downloaded and enter that code right there, the FHA, you'll see the valuation class pop up on your shelf as a class, and every lecture will go on that site with the lecture notes. So basically the whole class you can watch through that. It's actually a pretty neat platform for delivering the class. And finally, the YouTube channel. There's a playlist for just for this class, so every lecture will show into the, go up into that playlist. Yes, there's more. There's a Google Calendar that I sent to you about 2 weeks ago. Basically, it lists every session in the class, when the quizzes are, when the exams are. So no messing with me and say, I didn't know the quiz was this day. Yes, you did. You just didn't want to look. The Google Calendar lists everything due in this class, when it's due. You know. So my blog is a place where actually I deliver the most stuff. So when I value a company over the course of the class, it'll show up in the blog. So I'll direct you to that blog post when it does happen. I have a Twitter feed, and as I said, now I've more my numbers up there. So whoever you can get me get to join my Twitter feed, I encourage you to get them on, even if it's by hook or crook. You know, as I said, they don't have to follow my tweets. So, you know. And finally, if you really find yourself with a lot of extra time on your hands after all this stuff, then there's more stuff you can find if you go to that reading page. Now comes the unpleasant stuff. Last time I made the mistake of making this pie the MBA pie. 25% A's and A minus. I didn't hear the end of it from you guys. What is it with you guys? And I did this in my corporate finance. 25%, that's not the undergrad. So basically I made it 30%, which I think is, you know, I'll give a little more leeway maybe. It'll be 32, 33. Okay? But here's the way I think about grading. Just because you spend a lot of time in this class doesn't mean that I should give you a good grade. It's not the way grading works. So here's my way of assessing grades. If you can value just about any kind of asset by the end of this class, you deserve an A. If you can value most stuff, then you deserve, you know, B plus, maybe B. If you can value some stuff, the C. If you can value nothing, even at the end of this class, then I don't think you deserve a grade in this class. So my job is to figure out whether you can value stuff, not whether you can plug and chug into equations. Already you can, I can see the fear kind of coming. Don't worry, I'm not here to trip you up. I want to make sure you learn enough valuation. And if all of you can value just about anything, guess what? I will give 100% A's. You say, you can't get away with it. Oh, yeah, I'm leaving on a sabbatical. What are they going to do? They can't even find me for a year after this. Okay? So if everybody here deserves an A, I'll have no qualms about giving an A, giving A's to everybody in the class. So leave that to me. I want you to think less about the grading. It'll take care of itself. And more about mastering valuation, because if you do, the grade will take care of itself. In terms of mechanics, here's what's going to happen. I'm going to talk a little bit about the project, and this project is going to run through the semester. In fact, it started already. You didn't even know it started. The project started when you walked into the class. So we're going to talk about this project that's going to stretch across the class. And there's going to be a second project midway through the semester that I will call a mystery project. You're saying, what's it going to be about? If I told you, it wouldn't be a mystery anymore, so leave it a mystery project. I haven't figured out what it's going to be yet. There'll be three quizzes. They'll be very creatively numbered, quiz one, quiz two, and quiz three. The first quiz will be on February 27th, right in session 10, second quiz. The quiz will be in the first 30 minutes of class. Okay. Take a look at this room. What do you think would happen if all of you were in here for a quiz day? This is going to be a nightmare, right? You're going to be bumping into each other. So for the quizzes, I will get an extra room, and about a third of this class will leave this room so that you can spread out a little bit more. So there'll be three quizzes. They're each worth 10% apiece, and they're all open book, open notes. So I'll come back and give you the specifics on the quizzes. The final exam, I was checking this morning. I still didn't see a final exam date specified for the MBAs are already. So once that date is known, I'll let you know. It'll obviously be after the last class, not either be, I think, the 11th or the 12th or the 16th of May. So, but as soon as I know, I will let you know as well. It'll be a two-hour exam. It's worth 30%. So 30%, three quizzes worth 10% apiece, evaluation project worth 30%, a mystery project worth 10%. So I'm going to be explicit about my quiz rules, because this is something that does get, you know, people get really uptight about. First is, The quizzes will be on the days that I specified. There'll be no late quizzes, early quizzes, simply because the logistics are impossible. Okay. There'll be open book, open notes. You can have as many books as you want, as many notes as you want. But remember, 30 minutes, if all you're doing is checking notes and books, you're already way behind. You're going to not be able to finish the quiz. If you have to miss a quiz for good reason, in case you're curious, if you go to my website, I'll actually list good reasons. Things like you're sick. You know, you don't have to give me a doctor's note. I will trust you when you say you're sick, which effectively means that you really can miss a quiz and I really have no way of stopping you, because you just be at least be creative enough to come up with a good reason. Okay? So it could be that you have an interview. So I cut you a lot of slack. But if you do miss a quiz, here's what's going to happen. The 10% on that quiz will get moved to the remaining quizzes and the final exam. See, how does that work? Let's say you missed the first quiz, 10%. The minute you miss that 10%, I will move 2.5% of that 10% to quiz 2, 2.5% to quiz 3, and 5% to the final exam. If you miss quiz 2, I'll take the 10% and move it to quiz 3 and the final. If you miss quiz 3, I'll move it all to the final. See, that's very complicated. Why do you? Because I can't let you move quiz scores backwards. Because you know what that's going to create. Let's say you do really well in the first two quizzes. You know what you're going to be tempted to do? Is miss quiz 3 so you can make quiz... No. I've played this game long enough to know how your perverse little minds work. So my job is to stay one step ahead of you. So if you miss any quizzes or exams, everything moves forward. Right? You're saying, what's the cost then of missing a quiz? If you take all three quizzes, you get an option. And here's the option. I will take your worst quiz score and replace it with the average scores on the rest of your exams. So let's do a what if. Let's say on the first quiz, you really have a bad day. You get a 3. But then you get an 8, 8, and a 24 on your two other quizzes in the final exam. In other words, you got an 80% on the rest of your exams. I will take the 3 you got in the worst quiz and replace with an 8. Okay? So I don't throw any quizzes out, but I do replace your worst quiz on average. But you get that option. So when you think about missing a quiz for no really good reason, but you're being creative and you've come up with a good reason, this is the cost I want you to think about, you know, of missing a quiz. So you can never be worse off by taking a quiz. That's what I want. So the system I've designed is there's no scenario. There are scenarios where you might be just as well off, but you can never be worse off. I grade all your quizzes. So don't take anything out on the TAs. I will grade the quizzes. I grade them quickly but sloppily, which means that I will sometimes screw up. If I screw up, don't stew in your own juices. Don't sit there bitching and moaning about how badly I grade. Just come in and tell me I don't like, I think you made a mistake and I'll fix it. You can use your, you cannot use your laptops during the quiz. So no Excel. I do realize that some of you will download the lecture notes onto your iPads. And rather than make you print everything off, if you want to use your iPads for the lecture notes, that's fine, but no connectivity. So you can't be using Microsoft Office on your iPad or your Android tablet or whatever you're doing. So I'm okay with you using tablets the same way you'd use notes. On the group, here's what you get. The project is a group project. So already I want you to think about, how many of you are seniors in this class? Well, that's not that many. How many of you are juniors? Okay, most of the class is juniors. Already you know the people you don't want to be with in a group, right? I mean, come on, over 2 years you've accumulated enough experiential evidence that these are people you want to avoid like the plague. So I hope you use that experience in deciding the groups that you're going to create. I will not put you in a group. I will not be responsible for whatever happens afterwards. So you have to start thinking about groups. The groups can be up to 8 people. But in your, remember, if you have a group of 8, you've got to get meetings of 8 together. That's a bit of a nightmare. So factor that. You know? So anywhere between 4 and 8 people in a group. You'll get one grade as a group. So don't come to me after the final project. I did all the work on this project. Can I get the A and you can give these guys Cs? You know what? Don't even try that. It's not going to work with me. get used to it. This is the way the real world works. Sometimes group work, you're going to carry the group. Other times, other people in the group are going to carry you. Okay? So there'll be one group. All group work will be self-policed. You know what I mean by that? There's always that one group member who's pissing you off. Figure out something to get his or her attention. I'd suggest you watch the movie Godfather. There are very creative ways in which you can get people to do what you want them to do. Like especially the part where the head of the horse is put right on the bed. Okay? So I'll let you figure that out. The rules on individual work, no, all exams and quizzes are individual. Why is everybody studying that? Am I not entitled to go till 3:15? No? I haven't taught under, is it 2 to 3:15 or 2 to 3:10? 3:15. Okay, I'm going to go out 3 more minutes. I'm never going to end early. Let's get used to it. I might run a couple of minutes late, but never early. Okay. And I, as I said, all the grading. For participation in this class, anything goes. In fact, my job in this class is to make sure you don't turn on each other. Because you know what's going to happen. You're a participator. There are people who don't like participators. You know, they give you bad looks and say, how dare you, ask that many questions. Leave that to me. I'll take care of it. So don't worry about getting the stuff done. We'll get it done. So here's what I'd like you to think about for the project. Because the project is going to get started. I might as well get you started on it today because it's never too early to get started. The project is going to require each of you to value a company. Each of you. You're saying, what's this group going to do then? Within each group, you're going to have to pick a certain... I'm going to put some constraints within the group. So let's say there are 5 people in your group. Each person is going to pick a company to value. You can pick any company one. There's to be nothing needs to tie them together. Unlike the corporate finance class, we have to pick a common theme or a project. You can pick 5 different companies. Here are the constraints. So at least one of your 5 companies has to be a money-losing company. Why? Because it's much more of a challenge valuing money-losing companies. At least one of your 5 companies has to be a high-growth company. You can pick a social media company, a technology company. At least one of your 5 companies has to be a non-US company. At least one of your 5 companies has to be a service company. Now, here's what's going to happen. You create a group of 4, and a 5th person wants to join. You can extract your own pound of flesh. You know what you can make the 5th person do? Value a money-losing, high-growth, emerging market company and take care of all the constraints. Okay? I'll be quite honest. Your project will run much more easily if you all value Con Ed, so much less work. But if you want to learn valuation, pick a difficult company to value. Okay? So what I'd like you to do then, before Wednesday, start thinking about a group, start thinking about companies. And this project is going to basically be in 2 parts. Okay? March 24th, which is right after the spring break, I'm going to ask you to turn in a portion of the project, your discounted cash flow evaluation, just for feedback. So I'm not going to grade it. It's your one chance for me to take a look and say, maybe you want to fix this, maybe you want to fix that. And then May 8th, which is the last day of class, 5 p.m., you will turn in your entire project report. So this project will run through the entire semester. Everything we do in this class, you will try out on your company. So I will see you on Wednesday, and if you can get the lecture notes by then, that'll be great. No? But you don't need to be at NYU class. My primary place for putting everything is on my website. You don't need to go to NYU class. All the lecture notes, everything will be there, including the lecture. You're welcome. Yeah, you can, you're welcome to do it. So just, you know, you can do it on your own and value your own company. You can join a group. The problem with joining a group is they might feel if you're not enrolled in the class that you will not be as invested. So maybe you should just pick a company and do it. No. Okay, take care. You have to decide to pick one currency. Yeah, any numbers you project, which are actually dollar numbers or currency numbers, you have to pick a single currency up front. Currency is a measurement device. So why does changing numbers change anything about your valuation? Right? Nothing changes. You have to do that right at the start. You have to decide. So you're taking a U.S. company buying a European company. You have to either decide to do the valuation in U.S. dollars or you have to do it in euros if you want to do it as a combined company. You can't let two currencies float around your valuation for very long. Yeah. Well, you can build your own race. You know. Some of them will be attached because modeling can take you only so far. If you're not familiar with how to build up, right? No, that's fine. That's fine. Hi, how are you? Take care. You don't have to come to class. You've taken the whole class. So if you want to sit in, you're welcome to. If not, no. You know what number you're on the radio?